This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the holiday week on the Darren Fort with me, John Adirola, and also Brooke Thomas.
Yay! It is Christmas week, holiday week.
Mm-hmm.
I was about to make a Janine Pirro joke.
Well, she's alluding to the fact that the impersonation of Janine Pirro on SNL is very good. And we will be talking a little bit about SNL a little bit later on, which is not something we often do, but I am always
on the lookout. It was great though, yeah.
Well, there's a reason though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. I am like constantly, if you're here, it's like a joke, but it's a truth that it's like always like, John, hey John, mm-hmm. That's me. So on the weekends, I try to give John a break.
Mm-hmm.
And
you do.
I wanted to text you.
I would prefer texts on the weekend.
Are you watching?
Unless, yes.
I wanted it so bad, but I put my phone down.
Okay, well, that would be fine. I don't have a problem with that. But anyway, we will be talking briefly about that. That's like the smallest thing we're talking about. In just a minute, we're going to be breaking down some of the apparent long-term effects over a couple of years of the Trump tax cuts. We also have US Senate candidate in Texas, Seema Hernandez, is going to be joining us once again on the show. Later on, donor email from one of the fundraisers for Pete Buttigieg. Some really interesting stuff in there. And we almost never do this, but this week we have a couple of shows that are going to be non-live. So I wanted to make sure that we touch base with what's going on around the world. So we have a Monday, meanwhile, in with Brooke. So that should be a lot of fun too. So with that, why don't we jump right into it. In the lead up to the passage of the Trump tax cuts of a couple of years ago, a lot of promises were made. Just about everything that you could ever hope to imagine would be true of a set of tax cuts was promised that it was going to, in fact, against all odds and reason, raise tax revenue somehow. It was going to stimulate job growth. It was going to lead to business investment. It was going to lead to jobs and wages and all of that. All of those promises were made. So it's been a couple of years. And there's only one thing we can say for sure was done.
Uh-huh.
And that is that $1.8 to $2 trillion was transferred almost wholly to the richest people and corporations in the country. All the other stuff is speculation. But now we have a couple of years of data. So why don't we look at what's been going on and see if we can learn anything about this. Now, bear in mind initially, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said that the law would juice the nation's gross domestic product to 3%, which would be good. Or as Trump said, 6%, which would be unheard of in modern American history. But that's what he promised, 6% gross domestic product growth. And so here's what we got. The economy grew 2.9% last year, exactly the same as in 2015 before the passage of the law. So
when that other person was president, the normal
president. I don't remember that
president.
Person, George W.
Stop
no, I'm
it.
Kidding. So here's the thing, like Mnuchin said 3%, which is a reasonable promise to make considering that that's kind of what the economy was doing anyway.
Mm-hmm.
To say that it's gonna be 6%, that's impressive. And we didn't reach it, we reached 2.9. The same as we had before we took $2 trillion and lit it on fire effectively. So that's sort of a baseline idea of what was going on. We can look at year by year, by the way, or actually quarter by quarter. Let's take a look at the last few years in GDP growth. And you can see right there the line marking where the tax overhaul was adopted in the beginning to middle of 2017. And there has been some quarters that are not bad. And then overall, if you were to average that out, it looks a lot like late 2015 to 2017, honestly. And the price that you had for basically maintaining the level of GDP growth was, again, trillions of dollars. And some of it will just continually go up. So we always talk about it's like a $1.8 trillion thing. That's over the first decade, basically. But remember that at the end of that, the tax changes for regular families, they're supposed to end. It almost never actually works that way, but to the letter of the law, they're supposed to end. The corporate tax cut, the massive, effectively cutting in half how much corporations pay in tax, that is permanent. So that $1.8 trillion, that's just for the first 10 years. That is gonna continually go up year after year after year until these tax cuts are finally reversed.
You know, there was something else that I found out about the tax cuts last week, and I wanna talk about it because I think we repeatedly we're finding out more ways. We knew just overall this was going to be bad for the people who need it the most. And this is going to be extra for no reason for the very, very, very rich and corporations.
Yeah. No reason that most people would agree with anyway.
Right. But yeah. So there's an aspect of this, the federal child tax credit. I think everybody knows about that. It's a credit that it initially is supposed to be like an anti-poverty help. But the way it's kind of set up, it really is just a tax incentive. It's a tax credit because you can't get the maximum amount of money unless you make a certain amount. And so the people you would think who need it the most would be like single mothers, single fathers who don't make a lot of money. It would be nice to just get like a bonus because to help your kids. Yeah. And that's not how it happens. You have to make a certain amount of money.
It's not an actual money that goes to you. It's a reduction in taxes. So unless you're paying a certain amount of taxes, you don't
can't get it
actually
back.
Get it.
Exactly. And so that's kind of always been the problem with this. Mm-hmm. It's so even more, as part of this tax act, Trump doubled the maximum credit in this program and it extended it to families who make as much as $400,000 a year, up from the max it was at $110,000. So now you can get back up to $2,000 if you make $400,000 a year. And so there's
it's
a woman profile.
Poverty for people who make $400,000 a year.
And there's a woman who makes minimum wage. She worked 5 jobs. So a bunch of different part-time jobs, as well as her full-time job, earning under $15,000. And she got an increase of $75. She didn't get the maximum amount because she doesn't make enough.
She doesn't make enough to benefit.
Yeah. Right, but it was extended for really, really rich people. I just like can't imagine thinking people who make $110,000 a year don't necessarily need a child tax credit. Mm-hmm. But thinking that for some reason this needs to be extended to people who make almost $500,000 a year.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah, it was a messed up law. Yeah, and it was clearly written to benefit certain types of people.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the charts for just a sec. Mm-hmm. If you want to take a look at, so the overall the GDP is not growing. But by the way, whenever we look at something like GDP growth, you can say we look at it before and after a law, but that's not the only thing that happens. It could be that something bad happened and the tax cuts helped to offset some of that. So let's look at a different measure. What about job growth? Well, take a look at this chart, try to make sense of that. I don't know, it's up and down a lot. If the average is higher in the red than in the blue, it is not discernible to human vision.
Right.
It certainly doesn't seem as if it exploded job growth. Now, to the credit of at least the last couple of years, if not specifically the tax cut law, take a look at this chart. Average hourly earnings has continued to trend up. It was already trending up in 2015. It continued to do so. Now, bear in mind that even the red section is still barely above inflation. So in real terms, you're not necessarily making any more money from year to year.
And the key word
there. But that's the most positive chart I was able to find.
Yeah, but the key word there, you said it yourself, continued. Because luckily for Trump, he wasn't handed the same economy that President Obama was handed. Mm-hmm. Now, albeit not perfect, but it wasn't the same.
Yeah, exactly. And one thing that we did find, a big change from before the law to the after the law, and it was 100% predicted on this network, if not on the show because we didn't exist then. You know what did go up? Let's take a look at this. Stock buybacks skyrocketed in 2018 because suddenly these corporations, which were paying a lot less in taxes, found that they had a bunch more money. Now, Republicans, conservatives would have you believe that if you simply give them a bunch of money, they will just make a whole bunch more jobs. But if you know anything about supply and demand, that is not at all how anything works. They make jobs when they need the employees to make products that are in demand. That's how it works. And if you're giving the money to the rich who are not gonna spend the money rather than the poor who would, then you're not generating more demand for products when you do something like that. Thus, you're not generating any reason for jobs to go up. But they do have a bunch more money, and so what do they do with it? They buy their stock back to gain more control over the corporation. So technically, they're using the money, but not in a way that has any positive impact on the economy for regular people. This happens every time they do one of these tax cuts. It was predicted in advance, and there you're seeing it. So it's very good for corporations, but not in a way that necessarily increases wages or jobs or helps out the economy as a whole. So that's the first couple of years. Hey, maybe the next couple of years will be good. But we do know one thing, by the way. You know what else went up? The federal deficit this year was $984 billion. And we said when you suddenly take in a lot less money in tax revenue, deficits are gonna go up. And they say, no, by the power of my Gryffindor magic, somehow you can take in less money, but the deficit will go down. Turns out it didn't. Now, there's no trigger in the bill where if it turns out all of their promises didn't come true, that it gets canceled or reversed or anything like that. The rich and the corporations, they still keep all that money. And those corporate tax cuts are still permanent, even though everything they said would happen did not. And everything we predicted came true. The law remains and the rich benefit.
Exactly. How proud are you of that line there?
Which line?
The power of my Gryffindor.
I wanted to work it in all day. Yeah. So I'm probably gonna do it in later segments, honestly. That's my new catchphrase. Anyway, we're gonna take a short break. When we come back, Senate candidate's gonna be joining us on the other side.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
By the way, I just want to quickly say, Bart, thank you for the Christmas music. Mm-hmm. I do appreciate that. I really like Christmas music. I like everything about Christmas, yeah. By the way. I know that I'm supposed to be engaging in a war on it or whatever, but it's like my favorite holiday.
You also just told us during the break that you have Santa-itis.
I do.
So
I like Christmas movies.
He's ready to be on school break.
Yes, exactly. Okay, with that, thank you, Bart. Let's jump back into the important news of the day. Joining us once again on the Damage Report, candidate for US Senate in Texas, Seema Hernandez, welcome back to the Damage Report.
Hi, John, thank you for having me back on your show.
Very glad to have you here and in the holiday season. There's a couple of specific issues I would like to talk about you with, but before we get to that, it's been a little bit since we last spoke about the race. There have been some developments in that race, so give us a little update. How is it going down there?
Well, it's definitely a crowded field, but mm-hmm. The one thing that we are very proud of is that our campaign is not accepting or soliciting any money from billionaires. We are 100% grassroots funded, and there is definitely a lot of work to be done in this election. Our campaign has been consistently leading on the issues, and as many of you know, I am a candidate running for US Senate, but I'm also an activist. I am a community resident living in a sacrifice zone. Not only do I sign the No Fossil Fuel Money Pledge, I am constantly fighting against the fossil fuel industry, organizing in my community, attending and organizing town halls around the petrochemical disasters that are happening here in our communities, and empowering our community to speak up and to demand more from our county and local elected leaders, as well as submitting information to the TCEQ about regulating the industry and talking about the Green New Deal and helping to transition our economy to a more sustainable economy.
You know, you mentioned there a couple of the different places you do not want to raise money from. And that last week became a big topic politically because of the Democratic primary debate, where there was this back and forth about wine caves and billionaire donors and all that. I will say that for me, I wish that the way that people fundraise to me should be one of the most important characteristics of their campaign that people judge them based on. When you're out campaigning, do you find that being able to say, I don't take money from billionaires, I don't take money from corporations, I don't take fossil fuel money, all of that, are you finding that to be convincing in swaying people to your campaign?
Yeah, absolutely. The people that I've come across are all working class candidates. And the one thing that is most important to them is having a elected official who does not pander to voters, but also doesn't pander to billionaires. You cannot serve two people or two masters. You have to serve either the people or the billionaires. And I decide to serve the people. That's the whole objective of our campaign and grassroots movement across the country. And here in Texas, when we only accept donations from the working class, that means we are only going to be working for the working class.
Okay. Well, you're talking there about the grassroots. I guess the exact opposite of that would be the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, which recently endorsed one of your competitors in the race. That is MJ Hagar, which many have noted is a former Republican. And their strategy seems to be that they think that in a state like Texas, having someone who used to be a Republican is a benefit in the race. I have a feeling that you probably do not agree with that strategy.
Absolutely not, but it's no surprise that they endorsed a corporate candidate who used to be a Republican. And I can tell you, look, I was not recruited to run by political operatives. I was not recruited to run by the political establishment, people like Chuck Schumer. And I am not endorsed by the DSCC. And that is a badge of honor for a progressive candidate in this progressive movement. Those people don't represent, nor do they know, the political landscape in Texas. And our 2018 campaign proved that with grassroots funding and a progressive campaign can win a quarter of a million votes with no media and no endorsements. Right now, our campaign, like I said, is 100% grassroots funded, and we've received the endorsement from the Texas Democratic Secular Caucus. We have been endorsed by Senator Nina Turner. We have the support of actor and comedian and producer John Leguizamo. We are consistently working and on the issues and leading on the issues that matter most. We know what Texas needs. And regardless of the media blackout that we are facing, regardless of the discontent of the Democratic Party trying to silence our movement, we continue to fight. And despite our considerably low fundraising numbers compared to the other political candidates, we are still leading in the polls because our message resonates with the working class people in Texas.
You know, I wanted to ask you about the general nature of the race, because on the Democratic side, as you mentioned, it's a crowded field. There's a lot of people. On the other side, there are other Republicans running to try to take out Cornyn in the primary, and Libertarian candidates as well. Do you think that this is a sign that people feel like Cornyn, like this is a moment of weakness where he can be taken out? Or is it just that, you know, Texas is this, it's this state that people have had their eyes on for a long time as one that could potentially flip from red to blue? What do you attribute the many candidates entering this race to?
Well, much like anything else, it's a opportunity to make money. And I didn't get into this race to raise millions of dollars and set it on fire by hiring political consultants and political operatives. I got into this race because I was compelled to run. I made a promise to people as I campaigned across the state that I would not stop fighting for them. And our campaign right now is 100% grassroots funded. We have volunteers. We have amazing people on our staff. They are leaders in the progressive movement. And we are excited to continue pushing our campaign forward. And those other people who are getting into this in this race, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, or recruited by the political establishment, they do not embrace the same progressive policies that we do, nor do they play outside the field. We are challenging the patriarchy of the political structure, which means although we may not be raising millions of dollars, we are also not upholding the same systems of oppression as they are.
Okay. And Seema, where can people find out more about your candidacy?
Oh, they can go to SEMA, the number 4texas.com. They can go onto Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I'm trying to think of where else I'm at on social media. There's so many social media platforms to keep up with.
There certainly is. SEMA Hernandez, thank you once again for joining us on the show.
All right, thank you.
We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, a released donor email from one of the bundlers for Pete Buttigieg is certainly raising some eyebrows. We're gonna give you that after this. At last week's Democratic debate, Pete Buttigieg faced pretty harsh questioning from Elizabeth Warren, actually, about some of his donation and fundraising strategies. And so in the immediate aftermath of that, what he really needed was to lay low. But unfortunately, that's not the case, because a bundler of his, one of these people who's like sort of loosely affiliated with the campaign but raises money for the campaign, had emailed a potential donor, and bits of that email have now been released. And I want to read it for you. This donor is HK Park, and the email read in part, "If you want to get on the campaign's radar now before he is flooded with donations after winning Iowa and New Hampshire, you can use the link below for donations." So again, this is not like a mass email to tons of people and like, hey, Joe, if you'd like to get on his radar. No, this is like, hey, if you'd like to raise and help bundle a ton of money for him, do it now so he'll pay special attention to you, because later he may not be, you know, as much time. Like, you're gonna sit farther back in the wine cave.
Can we just say, like, stereotypically, right? Because he says a lot of things that are just absolutely ridiculous, and he's been saying things that are ridiculous and absurd, but probably the most realistic thing I've ever heard coming from like Camp Buttigieg is, after we win Iowa and New Hampshire.
Yeah, well, look, he's still doing really well in Iowa.
Like, it's like so realistic that he's like, oh yeah, I got these two in the bag. Now, my own state, my city.
That's true.
Whoa.
No, that's not in the strategy. But yes, and look, he is doing well in Iowa in part because they raised millions and millions of dollars, and they're spending millions and millions of dollars. But he's doing well in Iowa. Yeah, there's a little bit of.
I think they call that identity politics.
There are elements. You know when Beto.
So stupid. It's a stupid phrase.
You remember when Beto said, I was born for this?
Yes, that's what that reminds me of. That's why that's so funny to me.
Like,
he's like, I got Iowa in the bag.
Yeah. And maybe he does. We'll see. Now, a little bit more from this email. HK Park is listed on the Buttigieg website as one of its top fundraisers, those who've raised at least $25,000 for the campaign. Now, what's interesting is that the prospective donor, the person that HK Park reached out to give money to the campaign, is now talking about that experience. And that prospective donor, who wants to be left anonymous, says, it's very telling and concerning that one of the campaign's major bundlers would talk like that. What would this suggest about the way he's going to interact with Silicon Valley if the implication is pay for play? If that's the way he's operating, it's in the public interest for people to know what's being said. He's running on an image that may not be his reality.
So he's running on an image that may not be his reality is something that can be proven in many different aspects, not just donor related. And also, like, yes, that is very spelled out, but we don't have to pretend like that isn't what it's been like. Mm-hmm. Like, we need it to be that spelled out to acknowledge that that's been the system.
Yeah, and by the way, I think we should focus on this, but not because, you know who's the only bad person?
Right.
Pete Buttigieg. Everyone else has been great and he's bad. No, he's, well, first of all, in terms of him being a mayor, he's bad in some unique ways. But in this way, he is bad in a way that the vast majority of every politician in American history for at least the past 50 years has been bad.
But you know what,
and we need it to stop.
There is there's an arrogance that also, like, we see sometimes with like Trump. It's been a lot of Republican policies, at least since I've been alive, have been disproportionately harmful to Black and Brown people.
Yes.
He just literally says it. Mm-hmm. But, and so then there's all of this like pretending, especially from like Republican never Trumpers, like as if they haven't participated wholeheartedly in the same system that just didn't spell it out. So exactly what you're saying, like, this is the system. He's just writing it down because there is this arrogance that, I find fascinating. That like you don't have to hide it.
Yeah, and look, they say that they were not behind this language and the way that the bundlers work. It's entirely possible, but the philosophy, the atmosphere of access, that is something that you contribute to. So our commentary after this is gonna have to be very constrained. Mm-hmm. But there's an interesting video that's been unearthed from 2010 when he was running statewide for treasurer of Indiana, and here is what he had to say about campaign finance then.
We need to get special interest money out of the treasurer's race. Right now, there are almost no rules constraining the ability of, say, Wall Street banks to pump large sums of money into state treasurer's campaign. And having looked at my own finances and seen what's happening in my opponent's race, I've noticed that thousands of dollars are flowing in from some of the biggest banks in the country in order to defeat me. It's not just that they're trying to defeat me that I'm bothered by this, but very early on in this campaign, I made a decision that I wasn't going to accept any money from a bank that could be doing business with the state treasurer's office. I think it creates a conflict of interest. It creates an appearance, at the very least, that can smell like pay-to-play. It's not good for the state, and I don't think it's good for the banks either. Who wants to be the one bank that didn't contribute if four or five banks are competing to get a favorable decision from the state treasurer's office? And so early on in this campaign, I announced that I wouldn't take that money, no corporate money from banks, no PAC money from banks, and somebody who works at a bank, we're going to hold ourselves to a limit that's lower than the official limit.
Okay, so there is a person who understands how this works and gets that, yeah, it at the very least looks bad and really is bad if they're giving a bunch of money because they want to have influence over you. And if you can understand on one level how they would want to influence Indiana's state treasurer, it's not a huge leap to understand why they'd want to influence the president of the United States. He gets it then. I would argue he still gets it on some level.
Yeah,
but he wants to get elected. He needs money.
Exactly. He gets that. This is Pete Buttigieg's version of voting present when it comes to progressive politics. Just lying. Like, it's all a lie.
I did not expect that reference. But yes, I think someone should just play that video for him and get it. You see that.
But as we know, were just talking about, he's been flip-flopping on things. We can point out things last month that
abortion,
are drastic.
Yeah.
At least exactly. This one, at least it took him 10 years to flip.
That's true.
This
it's more
one.
Gradual.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so his the pressure he's facing right now about campaign finance is probably not going to go away anytime soon. But we are going to take a break. When we come back, Eddie Murphy returned to SNL and it led to a confrontation with a former comedy great after this. This weekend on Saturday Night Live, Eddie Murphy returned after 30 years off the show. And in his monologue, it was notable for a few reasons, which we're gonna get into. But in part, it was a comment that he made sort of offhand that involved Bill Cosby. He said at one point, he was talking about how his life has
so
changed
great.
Over time. He says, but if you would have told me 30 years ago that I would be this boring stay-at-home house dad and Bill Cosby would be in jail, even I would have took that bet. Who is America's dad now?
But the way he says it, who's America's dad now? Which is
that's better delivery.
So funny.
Yes.
I feel like you have to like know their beef.
Yeah.
Before
the beef, you have to know the current situation because you may not know anything about Bill Cosby. If the last thing that you saw was 80s Bill Cosby, God, the recent news has been terrible.
Stay there for your own health.
Bill Cosby is serving 3 to 10 years in prison after being found guilty in April 2018 on 3 counts of aggravated indecent assault for drugging and sexually assaulting a woman at his home in 2004. Earlier this month, a Pennsylvania appeals court upheld the conviction. And while that is what he's actually serving the time for, he was accused of sexual assault and rape by dozens and dozens of women.
And so back in the 80s, when Eddie Murphy first started being known for his comedy, he was kind of like a raunchy comedian in a funny way. It was funny. He was very funny.
Yeah.
And Bill, he gets this call from Bill who basically like kind of scolds him for his comedy. Saying
which
that.
Which was raw.
Which was raw and a delirious, one could say.
Yeah, one or the other.
But saying that, you know, his work is bad for families, kind of like bad for black people, like he cusses too much, all of this. And so the joke is this, right? Like this idea that, like, you're mad at me for cussing while you're raping women.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
And that is kind of Bill Cosby's thing. Like we've seen him go on rants about like the black community and God forbid young black guys wear their pants saggy.
Yeah.
God forbid. Like
while
he's doing what for decades a lot of us didn't know about.
Exactly. And like to put it in context, like you were telling me earlier, like you would have to assume at that point in the 80s, Bill Cosby's about as big as a person
absolutely.
Is.
I can imagine like if you're like a young black comedian and you get a call from Bill, that's
he's
mind-blowing, that's life-changing. Yeah, that's dreams. And then he basically
attacks you.
Yeah, that's a horrible moment.
Yeah. And so Eddie
Murphy
had been on.
You've got to watch it, because luckily Richard Pryor comes in and saves the day.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't tell the joke on TV.
Yeah, a lot of Richard Pryor quotes on this platform are no longer recognizable as sentences once you cut out the swears, but they are good and they're funny. But anyway, so he makes the joke, and you would think that's the end of it. We can just evaluate the performances and everything. But no, Bill Cosby still has a spokesman. Isn't that weird that, like, even after all that, you're rich, so you still have a person who's just like protecting your public image?
Which, like, it's gone.
You would think. But they're protecting it. So on Sunday, Cosby's spokesman Andrew Wyatt criticized Murphy for the joke, saying it was Cosby who, quote, broke color barriers in the entertainment industry so that Murphy and other comedians like Dave Chappelle and Kevin Hart could perform. Murphy's jokes were disparaging, the statement said, adding, one would think that Mr. Murphy was given his freedom to leave the plantation so that he could make his own decisions, but he decided to sell himself back to being a Hollywood slave. Remember, Mr. Murphy, that Bill Cosby became legendary because he used comedy to humanize all races, religions, and genders, but your attacking Mr. Cosby helps to embark on you just becoming clickbait.
One must think very highly of themselves to be in prison on sexual assault charges and feel like they need a publicist to keep bringing themselves like more attention.
Yeah.
But also, that was such a small moment in such an epic night of comedy. Nobody was even really thinking about it. I think
it was funny in the moment.
If you got it, and then you move on because there was so much more happening. So like just this idea that is very Bill Cosby, like this idea that he really thought anybody cares.
Yeah, yeah. Although, I mean, it's America.
But now we care because you did this dumb stuff.
Well, we know he probably still has a lot of fans that are like defending him. So just briefly. So now we've covered the important stuff.
Yeah.
It was a good episode.
It was great.
It was. The monologue was great.
It was so great. We got like these five comedy greats, because I do feel like Kenan Thompson deserves his flowers.
Yeah, if you didn't see it, Eddie Murphy is doing his thing. And I think Tracy Morgan comes out at first and joins him, makes a joke. He had like had a sketch for him to do or something. Then Chris Rock comes out. Then Dave Chappelle comes out.
Yeah.
And then Beck Bennett tries to get in a word, and Kenan shoots him to the side. It was one of the funniest things the whole night.
It was funny.
And just, you know, like Eddie Murphy hasn't been there for 3 decades. And to see them all on the stage, it was amazing. Like, how rarely do you see that much comedic talent like all together?
And like them all being there to support Eddie, it was cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was nice.
Exactly. Yeah. And good sketches too. If you haven't seen it, I know that like SNL is like very, like a lot of people have not been interested in it for a long time.
This is the funniest episode I've seen in years.
Exactly. And you know, I get it. A lot of the humor can be like really like boomerish or whatever, but it's also pretty funny. And they got a lot of really talented people in there. Like Kenan is amazing. Cecily Strong is amazing. Kate McKinnon is amazing. Like it's worth looking into.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's great.
So we're gonna take a short break. And when we come back, meanwhile in to close out the show. And now it's time for news from around the world. It's Meanwhile In. Meanwhile in Laos, researchers set up cameras in a wilderness area to try to track how many tigers were in the area. And they found 0 tigers. But what they did find during this 5-year survey was evidence of snares. Lots and lots of deadly snares, which are designed to trap and kill any animals that stumble across them, potentially including tigers. And so one of the zoologists and authors of this study says that snares are simple to make. One person can set hundreds or even thousands of them, which kill indiscriminately and are inhumane for anything that is captured. And so what they believe this study shows, because it was again, many cameras, 5 years, they believe that the population of wild tigers in Laos is now 0 tigers. There are no tigers left. And what's interesting is that the most recent worldwide tiger population estimates released in April 2016 put the number of tigers then at 2 in that country. The observation of those last 2 Laotian tigers came from the first year of the camera survey. They were never seen again.
Wow.
And that is just devastating. Like,
it is.
How many times have we done a story where it's like they're projecting that by 2050 there will be no turkeys left or something like that? Well, yeah, like looking ahead, there's gonna be a lot of things like this, but we're also seeing it right now. And this is not necessarily just like climate change, mm-hmm. but the hunting and the poaching and selling body parts and selling the animals illegally can actually just totally wipe out this species. That's just devastating.
Yeah.
Yeah. And let's see. Let's talk about where there are some. So their only healthy populations remain in Thailand, which at last count had about 189. Again,
that's,
not a lot.
What?
189. Now, yes, it's a predator. They tend to be far rarer than prey animals.
Yeah.
But that's just a couple hundred. The Indochinese tiger, previously considered its own subspecies, also persists at unsustainable levels in China with about 7, Vietnam with fewer than 5. I feel like at that point you could say 4, 3, 2, or 1. And Myanmar, no reliable population count. Mm-hmm. And so in the wild, we're effectively running out of tigers.
Yeah,
there's
that's
almost
so kind
none.
Of scary.
Which is devastating, not just because of how few they are, but even for like repopulation attempts. Hypothetically, that leads to less biodiversity, less resilience to disease. When you have a population that gets down to a very small number and then you try to grow back up, there's not enough diversity genetically in those animals. So this could also, even if we take efforts, serious efforts to get more of them, it could still be dangerous for them in the future. And bear in mind that while they were not able to find any wild tigers in Laos, hundreds of genetically inbred big cats live in the country's illegal and notoriously inhumane tiger farms, where they're raised to be slaughtered and sold for their body parts. Laos has officially promised to shut down these facilities, but so far the efforts do not seem to be successful.
They're gonna shut down themselves pretty soon.
Exactly. And it's just like, when you think of iconic animals, mm-hmm. just impressive examples of raw nature, the tiger is pretty high up there. The idea that at least for this species of tigers, we could just entirely run out any given year with the small number that we have, that's just devastating and should be avoided. Meanwhile, in the UAE, there is this new social media app that's very popular there and around the world, actually. So this is Totalk, introduced only months ago, was downloaded millions of times from the Apple and Google app stores by users throughout the Middle East, Europe, Asia, Africa, and North America. While the majority of its users are in the Emirates, Totalk surged to become one of the most downloaded social apps in the US last week, according to app rankings. And look, it's not like a new social media app rises to the top of the downloads every week. And so this is really interesting. And so people were looking into it. And here's what they found out about this app that's sort of noteworthy if you've downloaded it. The service Totalk is actually a spying tool, according to American officials familiar with a classified intelligence assessment and a New York Times investigation into the app and its developers. It's used by the government of the UAE to try to track every conversation, movement, relationship, appointment, sound, and image of those who install it on their phones. And again, it is very popular in the UAE, but it's been downloaded all over the world.
Right.
And so we could go into some of the ways that it gets data are actually pretty clever and also probably exactly what a lot of other apps are doing on your phones.
Yeah, that's what's so crazy about the story. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so on the surface, Totalk tracks users' location by offering an accurate weather forecast. It hunts for new contacts anytime a user opens the app the pretense that it's helping connect with those friends, much like how Instagram flags Facebook friends. It has access to users' microphones, calendars, cameras, and other phone data. But the thing is, like, it's like, hey, it's convenient. It's using all this stuff, but not necessarily for you, for some UAE bureaucrat to look through.
Right. I mean, you can't even, and at this point, like, you can't even, like, reasonably expect people to stop allowing such convenience. Mm-hmm. And it's just, we are destined for
exposure.
Tragedy.
I guess.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. And now, look, from the point of view of the UAE, I mean, they're worried, obviously, about, you know, like democracy and the protests, things like that. This can help to track all sorts of different things. Now, look, we sort of alluded to it earlier, many apps are tracking your location.
Yeah.
You can't say a word without getting ads all about that stuff on other services that don't even seem related
so
in any way.
Wild. And we sound so crazy when we say but now everyone is kind of realizing mm-hmm. that, yep, there's no other explanation.
Yeah. Yeah. And it follows you. Like I at one point was trying to buy wedding bands. I already got married, got the wedding band. I will never stop getting ads for wedding bands on literally every. There are services that have not been dreamed up yet that I will someday get wedding band ads on. But anyway, look, this is it seems a level more, I guess, maybe nefarious. I mean, I feel like governments in particular, not just Not just like we've had cases where they will do deals with these companies to get access to some of their data. Or if a crime happens, they will go into one of their apps and try to recover information. But this is the government itself, apparently, through a shell corporation, putting out their own spying tools. And if the UAE is doing it, I'm gonna guess that they're probably not the only ones. And so this is at the very least a reminder that we should be very careful about the sorts of apps that we're using, especially when something just pops up out of nowhere. This apparently was a fairly simplistic like reverse engineering of TikTok, actually, that they used and made their own version of. Is there any information on more information? Unfortunately not. Spokesman for the CIA and the Emirati government declined to comment. Perhaps at some point we'll find out more, since the New York Times is apparently investigating this. But again, just a reminder, they're getting access to your information in many different ways. It's just a question of how far does it go, how many businesses, how many governments. So it's something to bear in mind. Meanwhile, in Australia,
such a good job with these.
I know, I love that. But the last couple of times we talked about Australia, it's for their devastating brush fires.
Yeah.
And so seeing the animals always hurts a little bit. But those fires continue. International and domestic pressure inside of Australia to do something about it is increasing. And now even Greta has weighed in, tweeting recently, "Not even catastrophes like these seem to bring any political action. How is this possible? Because we still fail to make the connection between the climate crisis and increased extreme weather events and natural disasters like the Australia fires. That's what has to change now." And so she sent out that message, implying at least that she's really talking about all governments, that they're not taking this seriously enough. But there was already a lot of pressure on the Prime Minister of Australia, saying that he was not doing enough. So he was actually asked about this, and here he is responding to that.
Greta Thunberg has tweeted her 3.7 million followers of videos from the Australian fires criticising the lack of political action on climate change. What do you think of her comments?
Australia and the Australian government will set our policies based on Australia's national interests, on what Australia needs to do. That's where I keep my focus. It's not for me to make commentaries on what those outside of Australia think Australia should do. We'll do in Australia what we think is right for Australia. And that has always been my guiding principle. I'm not here to try and impress people overseas. I'm here to do the right job for Australians and put them first. And that means putting the environment in which we live at the top of that agenda, along with the economy in which people live at the top of that agenda, and make sure we've got responsible plans that balance these issues to ensure that people have what they need going into the future and they can be confident about their future. And I believe they can. I think they can be very confident. I mean, right now, particularly here in Mudgee, where you've got the double blow of drought and fires, you talk to people, And what they talk to you about is their hope, and they talk to you about their future.
That's what Greta's talking about too, by the way.
That's a non-answer. Like, way to make it about like this is a foreign person who has no business talking about what's going on here, than to just actually like acknowledge what they're talking about.
Yeah.
But I mean.
So that's Scott Morrison, not interested in Greta getting involved. And that's probably because, look, he's in the middle of this devastating fire. I mean, you saw the lower third at the bottom saying that 100 buildings had just been destroyed. And so, like, I get that he doesn't have a lot of time to deal with Greta when he's hard at work dealing with this.
Except.
Wait, sorry. No, actually, he's going to be hard at work when he gets back from his vacation in Hawaii that he's taking while the fires are burning across Australia. So he's taking it very seriously as someone can take something while reclining on the beach with a Mai Tai in their hand. And by the way, so what is he going, so it's a disaster, you gotta deal with it. What are you gonna do going forward? Is this going to change your policies? Is this evidence that climate change is gonna have a very negative impact by making these fires more common and more severe? Well, responding to calls for Australia's large coal industry to be cut in the wake of the bushfires, Morrison said his government would not adhere to, quote, reckless climate targets in a Daily Telegraph op-ed.
Awesome, okay.
So when he says that he's gonna put on the top of the agenda the environment and the economy, he falsely believes that you can't do both in an environmentally sustainable way, and he seems to have made his choice.
He's just not answering your questions.
Yeah,
like he just feels like he didn't have to.
Yeah, well, thank you, Greta. We do appreciate you weighing in, because it's a really devastating set of fires. Okay.
Do we have time? Is that what you're gonna
do? Yes, okay, I want to. So we have some iTunes reviews. Love when you guys do these. So Demita said recently on iTunes, "Love this show. I'm a Tut subscriber, but came here to give extra thumbs up. Thank you, John, for all his work, as well as guest co-hosts and guests. Thank you and congrats."
Aww.
And there was another one. I thought you'd like
congrats
this one.
Congrats to you.
And to me as well, thank
you. That was the
Thank you.
You got married.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Yes. I think that's what I was
really, really fast, there's one other. This concerns you because you showed it to me. Bambi says, John made it to the shade room.
Oh, yes. My mom texts me in the middle of the night after the debate. John made it to the shade room.
Which I had not been familiar with.
It's okay.
But I enjoy.
I think this is your second appearance of the shade room.
Yeah. Okay, I got to find the first. Mm-hmm. As always, thank you for joining me on Mondays.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, everybody. We'll see you for the rest of the week. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.